as launching pads for the coming war against Iraq.
I hate to interrupt Uncle Don's.
Things have come to a head with a lawsuit filed by families of some of the victims of this New York stunt.
This is the 20th day of November, 2002.
Against a Saudi family and a major Saudi bank to the tune of some $1 trillion. Now rich Saudis find that their assets in the United States
and are slogging our way toward Christmas. This is Uncle Don on CFUR Radio, 88.7 FM in chilly, soggy Prince George. The show is Uncle Don Reads the Comics, a half-hour commentary by Prince George's Diarist of Circumstances. Uncle, UNBC is going to be visited by Gordon Campbell next week. I'm sorry, on Thursday, the 21st. I think we should all give him a warm welcome. Be up at the university at 3 p.m.
It will be some time before we see.
The municipal elections are over and a message has been sent. The people of B.C. have told the so-called liberals that they are not happy. Listen up, Gordon Campbell. Vancouver has seen a massive turning out of the corporate friends who have been in power there since the days of the Socreds. The new mayor, Larry Campbell, has promised the people of Vancouver a referendum on that other Campbell's billion-dollar-plus Olympic party for his rich Whistler friends. Whoopee, dump that boondoggle. Closer to home, three of the strongest city council proponents of the new gambling hall on the highway have been turfed. Did you hear the message there, Kinsley? Sorry about that, John Major. Take your money and set up a gambling joint in another community. The voters don't want to turn this town into Las Vegas North. Listen up. And our very own MLA, Paul Nettleton, has stood up against his liberal colleagues and refused to back the giving away of our major crown asset, BC Hydro, to Campbell's friends. He, alone of the 77 Liberal MLAs, seems to realize what will happen to industry in the North if the hydro rates are increased by some 60% to meet the California rate. That low BC rate is one of the few things that keeps industrial jobs alive here in the cold, distant North. Take away that advantage and Prince George becomes just another crossroads ghost town. Good on you, Paul. It took guts. I have listeners in the right wing. It has come to my attention that one of the downtown detractors of my show has been calling CFUR the Communist Front Underground Radio. This information gave me pause. If being an advocate for the poor and disadvantaged in our society is communism, color me red. If advocating that Canada should be a peacekeeper rather than blindly following America into her brutal overseas adventures, color me red. And if refusing to slavishly follow the propaganda of an unrestrained capitalist system that divides the world between obscenely rich and hopelessly poor is communism, color me red. I invite anyone who is so down on my shows that he or she is reduced to name-calling to put pen to paper and send me a letter with your views. I will read any correspondence on the air. Sign it if you dare. I reserve the right to criticize and ridicule any such letter. Go for it. Uncle Don awaits at CFUR Radio, 3333 University Way, Prince George, B.C., V2N4Z9. Congratulations to UNBC student activists. Some of our very own held a protest at the new Walmart store on its opening day. They held a mock funeral for small business in Prince George, much to the displeasure of the new Yankee store officials. I have to admit that my wife went shopping at Walmart. She bought a game that proved defective, and I, Uncle Don, crossed the threshold of said store to return this game. I did not enter without prejudices. I dislike Walmart's destruction of local business in towns where it is set up. I dislike the way Walmart exploits its suppliers and employees. Oops, I'm sorry, I mean associates. The new store is huge, but the impression is one of an oversized sand store. It is obvious that Walmart does not rely on an attractive environment to bring in customers. Unfortunately, the predatory buying policies of Sam Walton's monster chain make it possible to offer lower prices on many items. I selected two items at random for comparison. One was the game of checkers that I returned, and another was a more complex game that my grandson covets due to effective television advertising. I went to Zellers to compare their prices. On the checkers game, Zellers was within a penny of the Walmart price. The other game was for sale by Zellers for $23 and change. Walmart had it for $17 and change. How much loyalty should I have to a Canadian chain over an American one? With a spread of $5, the Walmart price is three-quarters of the Zellers price. At Zellers, I ask an employee about their sign stating that we will not be undersold. She told me that Zellers will match any competitor's price. Well, the time to meet that price is before the tag goes on the shelf. People are not going to go to Walmart to check a price, then go all the way to Zellers to get a match. I fear that the close of the Christmas season will see the death of Zellers and other stores here in Prince George. Supposedly, Walmart has a history of destroying 3 local jobs for every 2 associates they hire. Good luck, Prince George businesses. Pull up your socks if you want to survive. Now let's get back to the war on terrorism. None other than George Bush has declared that the men who attacked New York and Washington at the cost of their lives were motivated by extreme hatred of the American way of life. They hate our freedoms and democracy, he has said. Well, it seems that those dead hijackers have developed a lot of allies over the past 14 months. Lots of other people obviously hate those freedoms, and many of them reside legally within the United States of America. One of the freedoms that Americans say they value is privacy. They do not want to see their country become a police state using George Orwell's Brave New World as a template. What would people think if the government kept track of every purchase made with a credit card, every magazine subscription they took, every email they sent or website visited? Suppose that government kept a record of every trip they booked, every bank transaction made, every public event attended. The descendants of the Minutemen, the heroes of Bunker Hill and all that would not tolerate such privacy invasions, would they? Well, not unless they were scared, and scared they are. The propagandists and the media have whipped up a massive hysteria based on that terrible terrorist threat, and Bush Light has put forth a bill he calls the Homeland Security Act that would mandate the new Office of Homeland Security to maintain files of all of the above on more, on every American in one grand database. This database would include all of the files held by the government in various departments and bureaucracies, as well as material gleaned from businesses. It is being pushed onto Congress right now. Yes, freedom has its enemies within the United States, and the worst of those enemies are part of Bush's regime. The anti-terrorist drive stirs Trojan horse suspicions. That is the heading of a small item in the Globe and Mail. Said Canada's Privacy Commissioner, George Radwanski, I'm extremely concerned that September 11th and the anti-terrorism not be used as a kind of Trojan horse or excuse to expand the powers of the police or the state to intrude into our lives. Sounds like George has been listening to Uncle Don. Osama bin Laden has threatened Canada. I don't know about you, but I'm scared. Ever since sometime in September of 2001, I can't remember the exact date, can you? When a bunch of Saudis pulled some nasty stunts in the U.S., I've lived in terror. If some suicidal men destroyed the World Trade Center, how could I know that Prince George is not on their list? Well, not really their list, since by all accounts everyone who hijacked those airliners is dead, but there may be others. George Bush has told me so. So, and there is a man, like his predecessor, George Washington, who cannot tell a lie. This is not to say that the United States is not doing everything in its power to protect George's country from future terrorist attacks. And even though Canada is not doing our fair share of purchasing military gear, he's protecting us too. Good old George. His new NORTHCOM is selflessly protecting both us and the Mexicans, although neither of us asked. Since a grainy audio tape purported to be from bin Laden recently surfaced threatening to destroy Canada as we know it, Uncle Don has been making plans for the defense of Prince George. After all, what could have been more direct than bin Laden's question, quote, why did your governments ally themselves with America to attack us in Afghanistan, and I cite in particular Great Britain, France, Italy, Canada, Germany, and Australia, unquote. Did you hear that? He mentioned Canada by name. George Bush may forget that we are up here, but bin Laden remembers. American security experts have said that this represents a, quote, significant threat, even if the voice proves to be other than bin Laden's. Another security consultant says this is not to be taken lightly, as we are now on a list. This chilling concept of being on a list is not lost on me, as my American mother-in-law has warned me against speaking on the radio and writing letters to politicians, as these outrageous activities might put me on a list. But ours is a free society, and we are not in a terrible communist country or Concordia University or some other place with no free speech, so I continue to speak and write. But I digress. Uncle Don's self-defense forces are now accepting recruits to guard our most precious institutions from the imminent terrorist threat. Every recruit will be issued a brown shirt and a great bloody club. Terrorists are deathly afraid of clubs. We will all do shifts in supporting the institutions which form the pillars of our community, like the university cafeteria, the college bookstore, Pat Bell's constituency office, and Walmart. While on duty, we will be expected to harass swarthy individuals, of course, and anyone wearing a turban. And our First Nations people, troublemakers, all of them. Why don't they go back where they came from anyway? Sign up for Uncle Don's Self-Defense Forces in person at CFUR or send your resume to Uncle Don at CFUR, 3333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9. Be sure to list all experience with right-wing organizations and enclose a photocopy of your Liberal Party membership card. Today I have a special treat for you. I will not be telling you about how terrible the winters were when I first came here. If you want to be bored to tears, ask an old-timer. I do not yet qualify as an old-timer. When I came here, the winter horror stories going around were about the winters before the Bennett Dam backed up the Williston Reservoir and moderated the climate. Back then, by all accounts, the air used to freeze. Can we all just say that the climate is changing? It has been several years since we had one of those cold spells where the temperature hung around minus 40 for a couple of weeks, and the last few summers have been wet and cool. You don't have to be a supporter of Kyoto to acknowledge the changes in Canada. We're beginning to discover the effects of moderated temperatures. Insect pests are surviving the winters now, so the spruce budworms and pine bark beetles are destroying the forests. Tropical diseases are moving into Canada, so there are panics over the West Nile virus and malaria. The permafrost and glaciers are melting, making a mess of the far north. Roads, railway lines, and pipeline foundations are sinking. Wildlife migration is changing. The effects are the easy part. The causes are multitudinous, and we are just beginning to understand them. Some say the warming is a result of a solar cycle. Scientists know that the sun's output of energy has small cyclical fluctuations, but they don't know what effects these have on the Earth's climate. But that is just the input part of the heat cycle. The other part is the output of heat radiated back into space. It is the output part that causes controversy because relevant theories and the proposed solutions affect vested interests. The most vocal interests are in the coal, oil, and gas industries. They're doing their damnedest to muddy the water so we cannot discuss the heat problems rationally. There's a balance between the solar energy received by our planet and the energy that is re-radiated into space. The greenhouse theory of planetary heating holds that greenhouse gases cause some of the infrared energy that used to be radiated into space to be reflected back to Earth, causing a slight temperature increase. Greenhouse gases are generated naturally and by human activity. That human activity is largely the burning of fossil fuels. It is this part that the input that we can control if we want to. The average temperature increases appear to be very small. But during the last ice age, the average temperature was only slightly below that of today. Small changes have huge long-term effects, and we are just speculating as to most of them. We do know that an increase of a couple of degrees will cause melting at the poles and a retreat of glaciers. That is happening right now. The water released is already causing increases in sea levels worldwide. Coastal cities will be in trouble. Erosion will change coastlines, and many millions of people now live on lands less than a meter above current high tide lines. So we have an idea of what the effects of global warming will be. What can we do about it? The effects of human activities on global climate are very slow from the perspective of human lifespan, but rapid in geological terms. The Earth has seen warmer temperatures than those predicted for the next century, but temperature changes took place over vast periods of time, and life was able to adapt and evolve. At this point, those of you who think that the Earth is 6,000 years old may be excused for your bingo session. Rapid changes in climate have huge impacts on the web of life. Think of the extinction of the dinosaurs due to a rapid cooling of Earth. Since the Industrial Revolution, we have burned huge amounts of coal, oil, and natural gas, thus releasing stored carbon into the air as carbon dioxide. This is one of the prime greenhouse gases. The effects of carbon dioxide and other such gases are long-term. Supposedly, warming would continue for a long time even if we stopped producing those gases immediately. So there's a trade-off. Not long ago, a bunch of the world's supposed leaders met in Kyoto and agreed on a step toward reducing the emissions of carbon dioxide. Every country would cut back their emissions to reach a target based on their emissions in 1990. This was presented to us as a compromise that gave the environmentalists half a loaf and the producers of carbon dioxide half a loaf. What it did was produce an awareness of the problem, but no real solution. Those concerned about the effects of climate change received a slice, not half a loaf. Just recently, in geological terms, I took a course at UVic in environmental economics. This was at a time when the Fraser Institute was newly formed by its corporate sponsors, and it had first floated the idea of trading in pollution credits. Our class examined the mechanics of the proposed system and found it failed to achieve its purported goal. The Fraser Institute would have set up a method where industries which produce less than a target level of pollution could sell their surplus pollution to dirty industries that did not achieve their assigned target. This would have created a new financial industry in the trading of credits between industries. The problem with this is that it would create islands of pollution in areas where the dirty industries are located and cleaner spots where the cleaner industries are. The whole exercise sidesteps the goal of cleaning up the environment where it is needed. Now, this trading idea has been resurrected by the Fraser Institute and its ilk in the idea of trading carbon credits. Areas like the Soviet Union, which were deindustrialized by the change of regime, can sell credits for carbon dioxide so they know that they no longer produce to countries that create more than their targets, like the United States. Credits are sold, money changes hands, and the amount of carbon emitted stays the same. The financiers benefit and the planet suffers. As Canada deindustrializes as a result of the ill-conceived free trade agreements that our quisling leaders have gotten us into, our former industrialists may be able to sell the credits for carbon not emitted by the closed factories. Whoopee, capital wins again. Back to the idea of actually cutting carbon emissions from industry. Even this Kyoto gesture was too much for the folks who have their money invested in heavy industry as it is now. Change for them costs money, and money is everything. The United States has rejected the modest goals of the Kyoto Agreement, holus bolus. They have a valid point, but they hesitate to express it. That point is that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and there may be nothing we can do about it now anyway. It is politically unpalatable to say this, so they have their usual arsenal of weasel arguments that they throw at us like confetti. They may be right for a change. If it is too late to stop the effects of past gas emissions, and those effects will be devastating anyway, what good will it do to make a mess of the economy in the short term if the cure will be worse than the disease, for the United States anyway? There's the hook. The U.S. may be able to ride out the worst effects of climate change, but the poor countries will bear the brunt of the effects. A rise of a meter in sea levels will force the U.S. to retreat from some low-lying areas like New Orleans, but a country like Bangladesh will be mostly swamped with no place for the people to go. American businesses may even find ways to make money on the misery of other, more vulnerable nations. Here's an item to chew on. The leaders of the United States are fundamentalist Christians. Do you recall Reagan's Secretary of Environment, James Watt? He made the statement that he was not overly concerned with the state of the environment, since it would not be long before the second coming of Christ, and then it would not make any difference. Is it possible that Bush Light's cronies figure that it will not matter if they despoil the planet because Jesus will be back to clean up the mess? Perhaps they think it will be amusing when the rapture sweeps them up into the sky and leaves all of those heathens to face the tribulation. That chills my blood. I oscillate between optimism and pessimism. During my up moments, I wish that the fundamentalist Christians might be right, that one sweet day will bring the rapture and all of the faithful Christians will be swept into the glories of heaven by a merciful God. Good riddance. We will be quit of the worst of the West leaders, a whole herd of parasitical preachers, and some of our most obnoxious and dangerous citizens. Just think of the benefits. The population problem will be ameliorated. The homeless will have the houses of the ruptured to live in, jobs will be opened, and, don't forget, the jails will be emptied. There's a greater concentration of born-again Christians in the jails than anywhere outside of the Pentecostal church. Certainly the prisoners are sincere and not just looking for a path to an early parole. With the worst of the superstitious out of our hair, we could get on with the job of making the world a better place. If the fundamentalists are right and that Jesus is coming again, maybe the next time we could listen to the lessons he teaches instead of making a business of worshiping his image. We could take the prophets out of the prophets, so to speak. Then there are my pessimistic moments. At those times, I am taken by a desire to study a musical instrument. I fear that the American Empire may emulate its Nazi predecessor and begin to systematically exterminate its opposition. The Nazis chose Jewish musicians to play as an orchestra while their brothers and sisters were sent to the ovens. Maybe if I were good enough, I could be chosen to play in Bush's orchestra and survive long enough for his empire to collapse and set me free. another chapter in the saga of the coming war. Whatever our concerns over the state of the province, the collapse of the stock markets, globalization, and all the other worries that shower us these days, the prime specter overshadowing our well-being is the prospect of war in the Middle East. I don't think we can overestimate the effect such a war could have on our lives. How can we make sense of all the propaganda and conflicting reports that flood the news media every day? Are we in a clash of civilizations between the Muslim world and the Judeo-Christian world? Is it all about access to a dwindling stock of oil? Is it a standoff between terrorist and peaceful states? Is it all of this or none of it? If we sift through enough reports from disparate sources, we can get an inkling of what it is all about. First of all, Iraq is said to have oil reserves second only to Saudi Arabia. Control of this oil means power, literally and figuratively. We know that Saddam Hussein is a nasty bastard, but the world is full of rulers like him. Without the oil in the equation, who would care? There are worse rulers in African states and Latin America, but no one seems to care unless there is oil or some other precious resource at stake. Saddam Hussein used to be America's boy. United States gave him massive amounts of aid when he was at war with Iran. But America is fickle about its stooges. Remember the demise of Suharto, Noriega, Somoza, Duvalier, Diem, and dozens of others who fell out of favor, usually because they ceased to follow American orders. A recent article in the Globe and Mail quoted a U.S. Senator, Richard Lugar, as saying, quote, "As a part of our plan for Iraq, in addition to identifying the political leadership and the coalition and building democracy, we're going to run the oil business. We're going to run it well, we're going to make money, and it's going to be help pay for the rehabilitation of Iraq," unquote. Now that's a mouthful. First they want to destroy the part of Iraq that Bush the Elder did not wreck in 1991, and subsequently they want to run the oil business. That means American companies pumping and selling the oil. Some of the profits from the sale of these Iraqi assets will be used to pay American construction companies to rebuild the infrastructure that will then be run by private companies, presumably all largely American, to serve the people who might be left in Iraq. No wonder the big companies back son of a Bush. Big bucks. Line up here. Campaign funds gratefully accepted. The same article quotes a Senate panel as estimating the cost of rebuilding Iraq at hundreds of billions of dollars, requiring the presence of large numbers of troops and specialists, presumably foreign, for years. Jobs, 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 as Mulroney used to say. Behind this ideal picture of altruistic Americans rebuilding a society they have destroyed while sucking away its natural resources, there's the prospect of money. Lots of money. How much is a life worth in barrels of oil? It had better not be much, since the toll of Iraqi deaths due to the war just since the end of the last overt slaughter has been estimated at over 1 million. If the press is to be believed, the government of son of a Bush cannot agree on what might topple their nemesis, Saddam Hussein. Bush has already authorized the CIA and other clandestine groups to try to kidnap or assassinate him. Dissident exiles are being curried in hopes of establishing some credible government in exile. Some military experts say that the current government in Iraq can be overthrown with air power supplemented with small mobile attack units of the type being used now in Afghanistan. Some say that a massive invasion would be necessary on land with at least 250,000 soldiers. What I have not seen in print or heard on the air is the prospect of a decapitation of the current government in Baghdad with nuclear weapons. There is a foreshadowing of this in the policy statements by Bush, the Bush regime, that nuclear weapons are no longer considered to be only second-strike weapons. They have avowed that they are not reluctant to use such weapons first. Watch for a set-up provocation. We've already had the American Defense Secretary state that there are definitely al-Qaeda in Iraq. Right. One thing that the U.S. and Iraq agree upon is that the Muslim extremists are dangerous to both of the regimes. I find the idea of an al-Qaeda being welcome in Iraq to be unbelievable. Unbelievable, but useful to anyone looking for a justification to attack that country. One thing is clear from the experience in Afghanistan and elsewhere. You cannot parachute a democracy into a country. Democracy takes generations to build, and we are still working on the idea here after a couple of 100 years of trying. Hussein's dictatorship will be followed by another dictatorship with a clique of the rich running the country. It is disingenuous to declare that this will be a war to free the people of Iraq. There's a story of one more bloody immigrant. 35 years ago, I crossed the Canadian border at Fort Erie. 15 minutes later, I was a landed immigrant in Canada. It was a bit shorter process in those days, once you had the paperwork prepared. In January, I found myself in Toronto, registered with a couple of private employment agencies in the local Canada Employment Center, looking for anything that would take me through the winter before my savings ran out. I attended a job fair at this Canada Employment Center one day and was interviewed for a job with INCO. They were hiring miners for both Sudbury and Thompson. The luck of the draw found me hired for Sudbury, and I was soon on the train north. I spent from January through June that year working underground for INCO as a driller. Maybe tree planting is tough work, but at least you don't have the view blocked by 300 meters of rock. I quit when a former roommate invited me to experience the joys of California, which sounded pretty good after a winter in Sudbury. It looked like the Vietnam War was going to end, McGovern was going to get the Democratic nomination, and the world was changing for the better. Things looked so rosy, so I headed off for the West. I had never been west of Ohio before that. A couple of years and a couple of jobs in California, and I was off to Australia and points west before returning to California in 1975. Now let me tell you about Sudbury in 1968. There was snow, there were miners, there was beer. Did you ever hear Stump and Tom Sudbury Saturday night? That was Sudbury in the 60s. There was no dope. I sure miss being able to smoke a joint once in a while. When I came up here in 1975 from California, I took a chance and brought a stash with me. That was before they had dogs at the border. I sailed across the border with paperwork in order. I needn't have bothered. There's plenty of marijuana up here, and there still is by all accounts. It is just as well that the customs folks were not too thorough with the new immigrant, or I might be up for parole about now. I'm with the Canadian Senate on this one. I cannot see what the big deal is with a weed when there is so much else to worry about in our society. There's Uncle Don's big confession. Sorry, folks, the statute of limitations is up on that one. Now for an adventure at the dump. We live out of town beyond the garbage collection services. I periodically gather our garbage and trash and take them to the dump. I try to coincide these trips with times when our grandson is visiting us. He loves the dump. Grandpa lets him throw the trash from the truck into the bins. Then he lets the kid shop at the swap shed, which has a large box of cast-off toys and parts thereof. Grandpa is exceedingly generous, and he buys the kid whatever he wants from the bin. Generosity is one of my strong points. While the kid is shopping, I pick through the various things that people have donated for the benefit of others. On my last trip, I found a couple of hardcover books, which will soon be forwarded to the recycle bins. Both were products of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. It is truly amazing what wisdom can be gleaned by some from an old book that was written by men who thought that the earth was flat. In these twin treasures are all sorts of history and ironclad predictions for the future. Amazing. Interspersed with the science fiction and fantasy, there are some fairly sound moral principles. Why do people need to believe in miracles and fantasies in order to have morals? Some of the most moral people I have ever met were atheists who based their morals on the Golden Rule. I refer here to the Golden Rule about doing unto others, not the one that he who has the gold rules. Why build the massive superstructure of gods, saints, devils, angels, revelations, magic numbers, burning bushes, dudes swallowed by fish, and all the rest? Here we are in the 21st century, and people are still spending valuable time sifting through the works of ignorant dead men for wisdom. We must not have evolved as far as we think. That concludes this reading of His Holy Word, or something. Anyway, to quote the great former American leader Richard Nixon, "You won't have me to kick around anymore." Not for another week, anyway. Until next Wednesday morning at 11:30, this is your Uncle Don on CFUR Radio 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. I leave you with a quote from our favorite philosopher, George Orwell. "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidarity to pure wind."